welcome to the show. I'm Michael Slate, and this is the Michael Slate Show. And that's Sandy Nelson with Let There Be Drums. Just got to keep telling people that because I'm always tempted to let it keep playing through the entire show, you know? Just keep just running the reel, man. Just letting it play over and over and again. It's really a tremendous song. Anyway, towards the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with Werner Butte. Werner's the writer and director of a film I saw recently called Plastic Planet. It's a really interesting documentary about the impact of plastic on the world and on human existence, including the future. It's a very, very, very cool film and a very important one. Before that, we'll be talking with P.Z. Myers. He's returning for his monthly column. He's the author of Pharyngula, the most popular science blog in the world. And he's also an associate professor at the University of Minnesota. And we'll be talking about, we're going to do a survey, kind of the checking in with P.Z. about the critical questions that he's wrestling with these days in science, in sociology, in politics, religion, all that kind of stuff. So I'm really looking forward to that one. But opening the show up is someone who I've wanted to get on the show for a long time, and I haven't. And I'm really glad I've been able to do it this time. It's Chris Hedges. Chris is a fellow at the Nation Institute. His latest book is Death of the Liberal Class, and he has a weekly column at Truth Dig, and that appears every Monday. Chris just recently wrote a piece that in Truth Dig that was called Where Liberals Go to Feel Good. And as I read it, I thought, we really have to jump into this. And I went back and explored his articles over the last few weeks, couple of months. And the theme there is a pretty dramatic and important one, and I'm really looking forward to talking with Chris about that today. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Sure. Well, let's, I was thinking about this, and as I was preparing for the show, there was something that came up, that came to mind, something that I've read recently and heard, you know, many times repeated to me over the last few years, and that's a quote from Yeats, the poet Yeats. And he said, "The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity." And I thought that spoke a lot to your assessment of what the political landscape is like today. What do you think?
Yeah, that's the problem.
Mm-hmm.
The rage that is being expressed by our permanent underclass is a legitimate rage. They have been betrayed, not only by government, but by the liberal class that once gave them a voice, or at least a mechanism within formal structures of power by which incremental or piecemeal change could happen. And that's gone. And the liberal class continues to speak in the kind of bloodless language of policies and issues without realizing that the locking out of tens of millions of Americans from a system, forcing them into a kind of debt peonage, allowing millions of people to be cast out of their homes because of foreclosures and bank repossessions, 3 million people last year, 3 million people this year, leaving 40 million Americans in a state of poverty, tens of millions of Americans in a state of near poverty. There are consequences for this. And the inability on the part of liberals to rise to the occasion has allowed these very frightening proto-fascist right-wing movements to capture and channel this rage behind a very incoherent, perhaps even insane political agenda.
You know, one of the things I wanted to ask you, and maybe to put that in context here, you know, in an article you ran, I think shortly before the new year, you talked about the idea that there's always been this debate among people who are critics of the system about whether there's developing a world that's more akin to Aldous Huxley's Brave New World or George Orwell's 1984. And you say, not one or the other, but both. And that's sort of the society you see. That's the political landscape you see today?
Well, what happened was we allowed ourselves to sit by passively as we endured a corporate coup, a kind of coup d'etat in slow motion. And we were bought off with spectacle, entertainment, cheap, mass-produced consumer products, most of them from China, and credit. Real wages in this country have remained stagnant or fallen since the early 70s. And we essentially borrowed to maintain both an imperial projects and a level of consumption that we couldn't afford. Now that credit is gone, these mass-produced products are no longer easily affordable to most Americans. And we've fallen into a system that I think is beginning to resemble far more Orwell's dystopia than Huxley's. Huxley, of course, saying that it wasn't that they censored what we read, it's that people didn't feel like reading. It wasn't that they used overt, brutal forms of repression, but were able to sort of channel public passions and enthusiasms towards the ridiculous, the trivial, and the absurd. And I think that process was one which saw us stripped of our civil liberties, as well as our ability to earn a living wage, and allowed society to be reconfigured into a frightening kind of neo-feudalism. And now, as we face a different kind of landscape, a landscape where there's been a Weimarization of the American working class, an assault on the middle class, we are going to see much more overt forms of repression in order to maintain control. So first it was Huxley, and then it was Orwell.
Okay, let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and I'm talking today with Chris Hedges. He's a fellow at the Nation Institute, and his latest book is Death of the Liberal Class. He also has a weekly column at Truth Dig. And we're talking about the political landscape, the horrible political landscape today, and the lack of a commensurate response to that landscape. Now, Chris, one of the things you talk about in terms of the liberals and, you know, broadly, I guess broadly defined, and the fact that this idea that the place where liberals feel go to feel good, you actually say that the response of many liberals is the conference and that that's not commensurate with what's needed now. So can you talk about that a little?
Well, liberals have sort of an annoying habit of gathering in groups to sort of wring their hands and champion their own moral purity and talk in abstract and terms of sort of morality and justice and not actually build systems by which they can confront what's happening to us. I mean, they at once want to posit themselves as the conscience of the nation and yet don't want to act on any of those moral imperatives that will force them to endure discomfort or even forms of retribution. And we see that repeatedly in the responses of liberal apologists to the Democratic Party, where they will speak out and denounce the appointment of Daley as the chief of staff, or the prolongation of the Bush-era tax cuts, which adds $900 billion to the deficit, or the assault on Social Security. And yet when it finally comes time to confront these systems of power, they won't do it. They buckle. And it's a sad kind of cyclical piece of political theater that the liberal class has engaged in since the Clinton administration. They refused, in short, to stand up for sort of core liberal values.
You know, you actually cast Barack Obama as another stock character in that cyclical political theater embraced by the liberal class. And I was really happy to see you do that. I thought you really got things right on target there in terms of that cyclical nature of what they go through. And part of the thing is there is a point in this country about the way that elections are promoted as not only it's the way to change things and it's the way to and it not only is that in my mind, in my thinking, not only is that sort of really deceptive and not true, that elections aren't really the arena where people basically change things in their own interests, but it also worse than that, it gets people, even that whole cyclical theater you're talking about, actually ends up forcing people into this corral where all you're debating is what the ruling class has actually decided should be debated. What are the terms of the elections? What's the terms of the debate in society? What do you got to do about it? They're all set by this class that's ruling over society, and everybody engages in that debate as a critical part of taking up the election. So I think this is a very deceptive and dangerous dynamic that goes on around that.
Well, we live in a system that the political philosopher Sheldon Wolin, I think, aptly calls inverted totalitarianism. And by that, he means it's not classical totalitarianism. It doesn't find its expression in a demagogue or a charismatic leader. You don't have radical or reactionary movements overthrowing a decaying system and replacing it with another. Rather, you have corporate forces that purport to pay fealty to electoral politics and the Constitution and the iconography and language of American patriotism, and yet have so corrupted the levers of power as to render the citizenry impotent. It doesn't matter what citizens want. You know, the polls are quite clear. 80%, by the way, of the Democratic Party wanted a public option. They didn't get it. Constituent calls in the first bailout bill of $700 billion in the House and the Senate were 100 to 1 across the political spectrum against the bailout, and yet it passes anyway. Nobody wanted the FISA Reform Act, which essentially retroactively made legal what under our Constitution is illegal, the warrantless wiretapping and monitoring of tens of millions of American citizens. The war in Afghanistan has no real popular support. The list goes on and on and on. And the fact is, Barack Obama, political campaigns are run around personal narratives. Barack Obama functioned as a brand in the same way that Bennington and Calvin Klein used people of color and HIV-positive models to give their products a kind of risque feel or progressive edge. But the result is the same. I mean, the passive consumers were made to confuse a brand with an experience. And I think that change in this country is no longer going to come through the electoral system. And I think the Obama administration has, I hope, made that evidently clear.
One question I'd ask you about the conferences, you know, because I know that actually you do value to a great degree, I would imagine, the struggle in the realm of ideas and the fact that people do need to be discussing big concepts and including where we're going, not just, you know, let's get out and fight, but actually some kind of framework of where we're going and having that kind of debate and discussion that actually right now is confined within very, very, you know, like, as you say, corporate, a capitalist, you know, framework there in the sense of this is all we're allowed to talk about. But there are these conferences that actually enable people to go out and change the world. And that's very different than I think the conferences you're talking about in terms of the setting the terms well within the structures defined by the system. You know, and I'd ask you this, because I do think that, and I really unite with your sentiment about your demand that actually there be some kind of resistance and mass resistance that's actually capable of standing up to what's going on in the world today. And I was thinking about this because there's a point where Bob Avakian once talked about there's a place where epistemology meets morality. And to me, it seems that has a lot. Well, I'd ask you what you think about that. The place where epistemology meets morality, where it's just not acceptable to know something and not do something about it.
Well, I mean, that's sort of the paralysis that's gripped the liberal class and liberal institutions in this country. On the one hand, they can be very articulate about the malfeasance of the power elite, including the Democratic Party, and yet they refuse to act. And the line you quoted from The Second Coming by Yeats is apt. I mean, that you leave or you surrender those passions and that anger to very frightening elements within the society. And let's be clear that the anger, not only is the anger towards government legitimate, but the anger towards the liberal class and liberal institutions is legitimate. They have betrayed working men and women. And unfortunately, the people who have co-opted this anger have laid out a very disturbing political agenda, one with very dark undercurrents of racism and homophobia and an embrace of violence or a celebration of violence and a gun culture. The ideology calls for government to get off our backs, and yet none of them want to see an end to unemployment benefits or Medicaid, Medicare, Social Security, nor do they want to touch the budget of the military and the security and surveillance state, as if that's not part of government, although it consumes over half of all discretionary spending. So when you look at the actual agenda, it doesn't make any sense, but it's emotionally consistent, and it has an emotional appeal. So, you know, Dostoevsky at the end of the 19th century was obsessed with the breakdown of liberal institutions to ameliorate the suffering of the Russian people. That's what Demons is about. It's what Notes from Underground is about, which is sort of the book for our time. The underground man is the defeated dreamer, the person who went to all the Obama rallies and chanted, "Yes, we can," and then retreated in cynicism and disgust. And as Dostoevsky aptly points out, when that happens, when there becomes no mechanism, no safety valve to redress these grievances, then you enter an age of moral nihilism. And I think that is probably a pretty good description of where we are.
Let me remind listeners, you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Chris Hedges. Chris is the author of The Death of the Liberal Class, and he has a weekly blog at truthdig.com. And we're talking about the political landscape today and the response or lack of response to it, or the type of response to it that just does not match up to what's needed. Now, Chris, let's talk about, you raise, in the context of what you were just talking about, you raise another point which really struck me. You raised this in an earlier piece, the question of innocence and complicity. And the fact is not just that the people who are doing this to the society, but that ordinary people oftentimes become complicit in state crimes through thinking that they're innocent.
Yeah, and I think that very much describes where we are. Perhaps the greatest tragedy of the Obama administration is that it has codified the destruction of both international and domestic law that was put in place by the Bush administration. We haven't closed down our black sites, offshore penal colonies where we openly practice torture. We continue to prosecute wars, preemptive wars, and occupations that under international law are illegal. Preemptive war is defined by the post-Nuremberg laws as a criminal war of aggression. We have no right as a country to debate the terms of the occupation. If we want to uphold international law, the only option is to remove ourselves from both Afghanistan and Iraq. We have not restored habeas corpus. And this assault on basic civil liberties and international and domestic law is relatively benign, of course, to Iraqis, Pakistanis, or Afghans, but relatively benign to us in a moment of stability. But it has handed to the government frightening weapons in a moment of instability. The idea that the president can unilaterally target an American citizen, as he has with this Yemeni cleric, for assassination without due process of law. The implementation of the Patriot Act to throw environmental activists into supermax prisons. Very frightening roundups, largely ignored by the press, of Muslims in the United States. The constant harassment of people of the Muslim, of the Islamic faith within this country, just because of their names or because of where they live or because of what mosque they attend. These are all harbingers of, in a moment of instability, what will befall the rest of us. And, there's that great line from Hannah Arendt where she is living in Nazi Germany with the rise of fascism and is finally arrested and eventually goes into exile. And she writes about that period, and she has this wonderful line where she says, "Thank God I wasn't innocent, i.e. I wasn't defined by the society around me as innocent, because at that point to be innocent was to be complicit in state crimes." And I think that that analogy in many ways can work for the American empire as well.
Okay, one more question, Chris, and that is, you, a big part of this whole thing is your call for your advocacy of mass resistance. You say either we begin to practice a fierce moral autonomy and rise up in multiple acts of physical defiance that have no discernible short-term benefit, or we accept the inevitability of corporate slavery. And you yourself were recently arrested on December 16th in front of the White House as part of 131 people who were arrested protesting the war in Iraq and the ongoing war that the U.S. is waging around the world. Can you talk about that quote?
I think that is all we have left. And I think more than that, those of us who care about protecting a civil society are the last thin line of defense, because as things unravel, and there is no check anymore on corporate malfeasance, corporations turn everything, human beings, the natural world, into commodities that they exploit until exhaustion or collapse. Marx was right. Unfettered capitalism is a revolutionary force. And with no check on this corporate power, which is recreating a kind of global neo-feudalism, sort of impassioned appeals to the power system itself is not going to help us. The only thing we have left are acts of civil disobedience. I'm not even sure they're going to work, but it's all we have left. And if they fail, then what we're going to see, I fear, is a terrifying right-wing backlash, one which will carry with it very disturbing undercurrents of violence. And that's why I think it's especially incumbent upon those of us who care about these moral and civic virtues to get out in the street.
All right, Chris, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
Okay, and hope to have you back again soon. Take care, man. I'm Michael Slate, and this is The Michael Slate Show. We've been talking with Chris Hedges. He's the author of The Death of the Liberal Class. He's a fellow at the Nation Institute, and he has a weekly column at truthdig.com. We were talking about the political landscape today and the necessity of people to stand up and do something about it. We're going to take a quick break and be right back with one of my favorite guests, P.Z. Myers.
My eyes beheld an eerie sight, for my monster from his slab began to rise, and suddenly, to my surprise,
he did the mash.
He did the monster mash.
The monster mash.
It was a graveyard smash.
He did the mash.
It caught on in a flash.
He did the mash.
He did the monster mash. From my labyrinth.
All right, welcome back. You know, I keep getting people, whenever they hear that I'm having PZ come on the show, they send me what they purport to be recordings from PZ's lab out in Minnesota. I don't know, but I just said I'd play it and see what he thought about it. PZ Myers, he's the author of the most popular science blog in the world, and that's Pharyngula. He's also a professor at the University of Minnesota, and he's somebody who I really enjoy talking with because nothing is sacred and everything is subject to scrutiny and the test of truth. And I really enjoy talking with PZ. And plus, you know, he's the only person that I met, or he's the first person I met, who actually looked at the recent death of Jack LaLanne, and he died at 96. And PZ's summation was, see, I told you, exercise will kill you. PZ, welcome to the show.
Hello, glad to be back.
So you put Jack LaLanne in his place, did you, huh?
Well, it was joking. I mean, the guy did have a good long run of it, didn't he?
Yeah, I'd say he was still pulling airplanes in his teeth at 95. You know, what are you going to do, man? Anyway, all right. Well, let's jump into this whole. We're going to do a survey, kind of run through a lot of different subjects, and one of the ones that you've been writing about quite a bit is the critique of new atheism. And there's one that in particular you paid attention to, which came from a man named Stephen, I think, Osma.
Mm-hmm.
And who defined, actually, well, why don't you tell people what his critique was and what the problem with it was?
Well, it had a couple of problems. But one is it's actually a little bit trite. It's a fairly common sort of thing to do is to say, well, the new atheists don't really understand religion X. They are always concentrating on Christianity and Islam, but here's another religion, and it doesn't have the same flaws that those religions do. And I think that's false, because what he's doing is pretending that our problem is with some specific ritual or point of dogma or doctrine, when really what it is that, you know, we're asking that if you're going to say something very specific about how the world was created, how the world exists, what maintains the universe, it better be true. You know, you better have some evidence in support of that. And in Osman's case, he's talking about religions like Buddhism and animism and so forth, and you know, he's got a reasonable defense for why people believe in these things, but he doesn't have a good reason to have a rational person believe in them. So, you know, I just have to reject all of these other religions, even the ones I don't know much about, unless they can tell me something evidential. Give me some empirical evidence for what they believe in.
Well, you know, one problem that comes up with a lot of these guys is exactly that point that you said of, and he does speak to why people believe, but this point they argue of, look, religion consoles people.
Yes. That's a very common thing, too. And he's actually got a good point. I mean, I agree with him entirely. That one of the reasons people accept religion is because they're looking for consolation, they're looking for reassurance in times of trouble. And here comes this nice, glad-handing preacher, and he says, yes, you know, Jesus says that you will go to heaven after you die, so you know your loved one is in a happier place. And they're very susceptible to that. So people believe religion for what are actually very good, very human reasons. But I'm just saying that, you know, you got to go beyond that. That, you know, once you start thinking about this stuff, why should you believe in somebody's lies? I would much rather have somebody tell me the truth about what's happened and try to find some other form of consolation in that.
You know, it's interesting. When he talks about Buddhism, I had some experiences in Sri Lanka, which, you know, the regime in charge of Sri Lanka is a Buddhist regime, basically. It's a Buddhist nationalist. It's actually, in many ways, an encroaching theocracy. And if some of them had their choice, they certainly have at least an even tighter relationship between the rulers and the religious, you know, the dominant religion in the country. And they use it for the most outrageous things. I mean, I talked to Buddhist priests who had chopped heads off of Tamils, Hindus, and attacked Muslims, you know, and who were actually in the aftermath of the tsunami, when there were these relief trucks coming up the East Coast going into the territory of the Tamils, where a lot of Tamil people lived and who had been the major people struck by the tsunami in Sri Lanka. When now those trucks were going up and it would stop in these towns, the Buddhist priests would organize gangs of thugs to go out and take all of the food, all the fresh food out of the trucks and replace it with food that had expired and then had that sent on to the refugee camps that were filled with the Tamil people. So much for helping and making people feel good.
Oh, yeah. And often I get people telling me how wonderful the Dalai Lama is, for instance. And I agree that he's a charming person and he's got some very enlightened sorts of views. But he's the head of a theocracy.
Mm-hmm.
Let's get real here. That every religion and every practitioner of religion has virtues to them. There's good things that are embedded in them. You know, I don't completely reject everything about Christianity because I know many Christians are good people and there's some really good philosophy there. But you've also got to recognize that there's this, you know, that there's these elements that are supernatural and that are dogmatic that have to be rejected, even if it makes people feel good. Because what Asma's approach is basically saying is, go with the flow, don't rock the boat, you know, accept the existence of these foolish ideas, when that's not what we need to do now. What we need to do is actively oppose superstition and religious idiocy.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and I'm talking today with P.Z. Myers, atheist, developmental biologist, associate professor at the University of Minnesota, and author of Feringula. See, I have to keep saying it that way, P.Z. The world's most popular science blog. Okay. Now, let me ask you this, because you've also written, and I think it's important in relation to this, that it's not just that you want the truth, but you actually make an argument that people who try to swaddle truth with lies in the name of consolation are despicable, or that process is despicable. Let's talk about that, because you say it has dire consequences in the world.
Yes, because when you talk to scientists about truth, we don't think of truth as something that's chiseled in stone, that's absolute, that's something irrevocable and unchangeable. What we think of truth as is something that we as fallible human beings have to strive towards. We have to work to achieve the truth, and we're always ready to adopt our new beliefs and drop preconceptions if the evidence tells us this is the way it should go. So when these people say that this is less important, when they are saying that, you know, things like emotional consolation are more important, what they're basically telling us is to stop trying. And I find that contemptible, that we as people should feel an obligation to try and make the world a better place. And that means don't settle for lies. Keep working towards the truth as close as we can get to it.
Now, tell me something, PZ. You, just going up more broadly now in terms of this topic, what exactly is the difference between new atheists and old atheists. I just can't figure it out.
Oh, and I've talked to a number of new atheists. You know, they're friends of mine. We talk about this stuff, and we all just really hate the term because we're not new. We're not brand new ideas. We're just saying the same thing that the old atheists said years and years ago. And yeah, we're not improvements on Bertrand Russell. Okay, we're just this new iteration of the same old story. Many of us have sort of casually adopted a different spelling. We spell it GNU,
mm-hmm.
just because we hate this whole thought that, you know, they're trying to pretend that we're something new. If there's anything new about us, it's just a subtle difference in emphasis. Most of the people who are best known, I should say, as new atheists, are coming out of science and philosophy, and they're people who, you know, think fairly rigorously about the world, and what they're saying is simply, you know, we're used to trying to derive correct answers empirically by experiment and so forth, and we don't confine this to the lab. We should be doing this in every aspect of our life. So it's like they're taking, the new atheists, so-called, are taking a scientific viewpoint and saying, this is a good way to think. This is a good way to live your life. And that's, again, the old atheists felt the same way. You know, that's how they thought about the world, too. But maybe it's just that we're more strident about it.
And you have bigger parties. That's the...
Yeah, we're more popular than the old atheists. You know, the old atheists, I think they were smaller in number and they were more isolated. Nowadays, it's actually kind of cool to be an atheist, so it's helping.
Mm-hmm. PZ, let's move on to talk about this cat, Martin Gaskell, the astronomer who didn't get a job at the University of Kentucky, and he claims it was because he was discriminated against because of his religion. What's up with that?
And that's total nonsense. Gaskell, it sounds like he's a very good astronomer, and he's done a lot of very credible work in the field of astronomy. And he doesn't believe anything as ridiculous as a young Earth. He believes the Earth is old. He accepts the common scientific consensus that the universe is about 15 billion years old, the Earth is 4.5 billion years old, etc. But he's also been active as a Christian proselytizer, sowing doubts about biological evolution. He's been quick to distance himself from that now, but we've run across a number of his old writings on this subject and accounts of his past talks. And he's the kind of guy who endorses Philip Johnson and intelligent design and comes out and says, well, these guys have some really good criticisms of evolutionary biology, when they don't. He's clearly unqualified as far as teaching biology is. Of course, his job wasn't about teaching biology, but it was about the outreach. And he was not hired for a position after there was prolonged discussion within the University of Kentucky about him. And one of the issues that many people brought up was his habit of proselytizing for Christianity at the expense of evolutionary biology.
And just to be clear, this is a guy who mounted a defense of Genesis, the book of Genesis, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he does say things about how this...
Can't go further away from evolution than that, I'll tell you.
Well, you know, there's actually a great many theistic evolutions, including the gang at BioLogos, like Carl Giberson and so forth, who still argue for the legitimacy of the Genesis account of the creation of human beings. So this is fairly common, and, you know, it's total nonsense. There's mm-hmm. no way that could have happened. The scientific facts argue against anything like that ever happening. So, you know, it's a tricky situation in that he is very well qualified in one department. He has got some problematic political possibilities there on another issue. And so they decided to go with another candidate. And for this, he sued them. So it's discrimination against Christianity, which it definitely is not, because I guarantee you that there are Christians at the University of Kentucky and that they had no problems getting jobs. And it was never brought up as an issue in their job interviews. This was a guy who says crazy things in the name of Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what got him scuttled.
Well, let's one question around that is, how do you deal with those scientists who actually are also religious? I mean, it's sort of I'm kind of curious, but I've always been curious about how do they separate their religious beliefs from their scientific work? Oftentimes there's actually direct, very sharp contradiction.
Well, yes, and you know, I'm in a university. I've been in universities for a long, long time and working with these people, and there are religious faculty here, and it's not an issue because when you're at work, you're at work. That this is the place where you come to talk about your discipline and teach students in that subject. I'm an outspoken atheist, but I do not teach my students atheism in the classroom. So it's really not a problem. It's just a problem when you've got a few who do make it a point of open public advocacy in places where it conflicts with science.
Okay, well, let's move on to talk about something you wrote about recently, which is very controversial, and it really, I think, actually resounds with me in the sense of that we just passed the anniversary of the Roe v. Wade, and there's a lot of focus, a lot of struggle around the right to abortion. And in the middle of all this comes the case of Dr. Kermit Gosnell, the guy who ran an abortion mill. And really, this is one of the few times you can call it an abortion mill in Philadelphia, and who was, as you say, was a hack who maimed and killed women while doing abortions on demand for a substantial fee. You make the argument that this is not a case about abortion. Let's talk about that.
Well, it isn't, because, you know, imagine that every pro-choice person in this country got their way, and we had freely accessible legal abortions, and we'd have, you know, on demand even. And you know, even if we allowed things like late-term abortions on demand, which is nothing I expect will happen in our culture, they would not support Gosnell, that what he was doing was monstrous and criminal. It was a poorly regulated facility. He was a butcher. That's all he really was, a butcher for pay. And that's the kind of guy we would like to see driven out of business, too. You know, I speak as a pro-choice person myself. So, this is something where pro-choice and anti-choice proponents would agree 100%. Shut down the abortion mills, shut down Gosnell, try this guy for crimes against humanity. And that's the way it should be.
You know, it's interesting because you say try him for crimes against humanity, and you also make a distinction in terms of one of the things that he's charged with is killing babies. And you say, I disagree there. Why?
Oh, boy, yeah, you know, I have gotten so much hate mail over that because I said, you know, I came right out and said that embryos, fetuses, babies, they're pretty much just meat. They have not become fully human yet. And I think I would agree with people who would say, well, you ought to give more consideration to a newborn versus some fetus at the first trimester. That's definitely true. And so there is a sliding, gradual scale there. But at the same time, what happened here is that these were women who voluntarily went into a clinic. They didn't know it was going to be such a bad clinic, but they went there anyway, and asked to have these babies aborted. Why aren't they being tried as co-conspirators if this actually is the same thing as killing an adult? That there's clearly a little conflict, a legal conflict that ought to be here. At least it's a philosophical conflict. We do regard these as different from adult human beings.
And that's an extremely important point, and one in which we're going to wrap up this segment. I think it's really, you know, I do think that there's actually a question here, one other question, real quick. Maybe if you can do it in a minute or two.
Sure.
The question that nobody ever asks around this is, what is it that drives women to have to go to a place like this cat's butcher shop?
Oh, yeah, and in the case of Gosnell, wasn't it obvious that these were poor, desperate women? Women who want to advance, who want to make something better of their lives, don't want to be trapped in a pregnancy. And so this is something that's it's a class issue. It's something that opens up opportunities for women if they're not shackled to, you know, that business of raising babies all the time.
Mm-hmm. Now, one thing, this we will end on, and that is, you just said you get a lot of hate mail. Actually, people should send you love mail if they agree with you, seriously. And actually, although not this particular form, I saw on your site that somebody apparently has launched a campaign on the internet to pray for you.
Oh, yeah. They can go ahead. It's not going to make any difference. You know, prayer is totally ineffectual, so I'm glad they're wasting their time.
Well, I'm glad that you're taking it that way and not thinking you can just go out and walk in front of traffic, because what's going to be is going to be.
Oh, no. It's not going to help me at all.
But I did notice that you were disappointed because they had a contest of where you stood in ranking in terms of the worst Antichrist in the world, and you apparently didn't do very well.
Well, yeah, but that's just discrimination. They didn't like me very much. I think I sent a bunch of people over there to vote on their poll, though, and I think I've shot up in the rankings now.
Oh, good, because they did accuse you of launching a campaign to influence their religious polls. Okay, people should go to Feringula. It's an amazing site. It's just it's the world's most popular science blog, and PZ is just a person who we went around for a long time, and he will be back again next month. PZ, thanks very much for joining us today.
Very good, yes.
Okay.
Talk to you next month.
Take care, man. Bye. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. We've been talking with P.Z. Myers, atheist, developmental biologist, associate professor at the University of Minnesota, and author of Feringula, the world's most popular science blog. And according to Bobby Boris Pickett, and the Crypt Kicker 5, he's also the head of the lab that gave birth to the Monster Mash. We're going to take a quick break and be right back with Werner Butte. Right, that's Plastic Beach, and it's by, actually, it's really interesting. It's one half of the original Clash, Paul Simonon and Mick Jones. It's really a great little piece. A little bit later on, it gets a little bit better, but we're going to talk now. I use that because I saw a film recently, and it's called Plastic Planet, and it knocked my socks off. It just shocked the hell out of me. You know, because you see things, and I had my own experiences traveling around the world, and you would see things. I remember being in Sri Lanka on a back road deep in a jungle, and all of a sudden we look over and there's a herd of elephants, and what are they standing in but piles and piles of plastic? In fact, a couple of them had sort of those six-pack beer strap plastic strap things wrapped around its trunk. And when I saw this film, I was just reminded of, wow, we have really screwed up the world. And I was very, very excited about this film being here, and I was really excited to get the chance to talk to the director, the filmmaker, Werner Butte, about the film Plastic Planet. Werner, welcome to the show.
Hi, Miker.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm good. A little antsy after seeing your film, though. Give people a sense of the scope of the plastic problem in the world today.
I'm sorry, what's that?
Give people a sense of the scope of the problem with plastic in the world today.
Well, for the film Plastic Planet, I traveled to several countries. I think I must have left a horrible footprint, but for this film, for Plastic Planet. But I talked to scientists, politicians, people from the industry, and as you said, the film shows that plastic has become a threat to both for the environment and also for human health. And how was it for you after you saw the film? Did you change something in your life, or did you go home and see a lot of plastic around you?
In fact, the point that you make in the film of having people empty their houses of all plastic, actually, if you did that, you would probably empty my house completely. Okay, that's the, you know, and what it did to me was actually I kept thinking, I reached for a water bottle and I thought, oh, wow, you know, what is leaching out from the plastic into the water? Or the Tupperware, where you actually show people who went for blood tests and found massive amounts of plastics in their bloodstream and it was questioned about whether they used Tupperware or not. And, you know, you think about how this impacts you day after day in gigantic ways and in small ways.
I tested my own blood, and I was really astonished. I mean, I was prepared from everyone that there will be plastic in my blood, But well, when it then came out, I was quite shocked because, I mean, nobody asked me if I want the substances which leach out of plastic in my blood. And those are substances, they're very harmful substances, which are connected to breast cancer, to infertility, to obesity, to autism, to hormone allergic reactions, to all kinds of stuff. And because my grandfather was in the plastic industry, he was working for the German Interplastic Works in the 60s and 70s, I thought, okay, maybe it's only me, because I grew up with my with all the stuff my grandfather gave to me. So we tested the whole film crew, and everyone had all kinds of substances in his blood, and it was really shocking that we also made tests like baby bottles and pacifiers, dummies, I think. It showed that even in sensible, in very sensitive products like the baby stuff and kids toys, the industry is using an incredible amount of harmful substances, and this is something we need to stop. And that's why I did this film. And luckily, we have now wonderful reactions already from people in Europe. The film started already. So families started to stop buying plastics. The industry is going to, is making a lot now. Well, so-called effort. We have a member of the council, the parliament in Austria, who also stopped buying plastic at all. So there are big things now going on, and it finally brought us to the minister in Austria said, okay, he's going to ban one of the substances, and the European Commission now also is going to ban something. But it's horrible. You need to make a film until finally something starts.
And even then, you've got to wonder what. Even then, you've got to wonder what the hell is going on there, because even with whatever they do, you know that there's always, and especially looking at this, this is one of the things that I thought came out very strong in your film, is that, you know, you had, I can't remember what it was, you had 700 reports detailing the danger, the health danger to people, to humans, and to the planet because of, from plastic, and, you know, 10 that questioned it. And yet the industry was not willing to even open up a door to talk to you. And I think there is this point there that, look, these people have created so much plastic over the history of since the day plastic was first came into the world. And the point you make in your film is that that could cover the entire planet six times over in plastic. And that stuff stays for hundreds of years, you know, and when it breaks down, it's I mean, you found it everywhere in the Moroccan deserts, in the ocean underneath. You know, it's just sort of there's this plastic is everywhere. And really, it's a very dangerous situation for humans, as you're saying. I mean, one thing that got
me. You know what, Michael? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, go ahead.
When we said the film is going to open in theaters, the first reaction of the industry was they prepared a 14 pages long media kit and sent it to all the plastic industry, to all the plastic manufacturers in Europe, to tell them how they should react on this film. And if they have questions, where they need to go to, instead of, instead of immediately taking action, because every day those harmful substances are on the market, the industry is earning millions. And this is something, there are harmful substances, they are not good for our health, and others are making profit. And now it starts that supermarkets became aware of, and because many people now in the German language area started to go to supermarkets. So supermarkets start to come up with new products or try to find ways. But it's ridiculous. Those things are already known for 20 years that harmful substances can leach out, and that they're endocrine disruptors, that there are hormone active substances, and it's really horrible. But it's now if people start to be aware of it, and they are going to ask me what are there harmful substances in those products we are buying, and what's up with the baby bottles and so on, and I mean, that's the idea of the film Plastic Planet, to make people aware of the material which is around us everywhere and which might can contain, yeah.
And it does a very good job at that. And let me remind listeners that we're talking with Werner Butte, who's the writer and director of Plastic Planet, a fantastic film that is going to be available on DVD in April. And I will remind people again when it comes out in DVD, if it's not showing in your city or something, but it will be out in DVD on April. I think it's coming out from First Run Features. Now, Werner, one of the things, let me ask you this. What was the most shocking thing that you found in your exploration of plastic? Because you spent a number of years digging into this. What was the most shocking thing to you?
Well, I mean, there have been many shocking moments because I started for this film in 1999. So there was always something coming up, and which was horrible. But the first moment I was really shocked was when we decided, okay, I mean, maybe it's not true. Maybe all those scientists we were talking to, I don't know, had the wrong product. So we tested just one product and wanted to find out if there are harmful substances in it. And the first product showed that there are substances in it which are causing cancer. You know, a lot of phthalates, etc. And this was the moment where I understood, okay, it's really around us. And then we continued testing a lot of other products. And in everything, we found harmful substances. And as I mentioned before, we even found harmful substances in baby bottles and baby dummies. And this is really. And then I think, I mean, hello, what are we doing? And so the idea is that people, after seeing the film Plastic Planet, start to be aware of the material, to start refusing plastic products, because it's quite a cool thing. When I look to the families who stopped buying plastics already months ago, they are still alive. They are even having profit. They are spending not more money than before. So it's possible, and on the other hand, you can also refuse it. You can, if you have it already, you can recycle it. You can reuse it when it comes to plastic bags. But I mean, I feel cool when I'm going into the supermarket and I'm taking my own bag out.
Okay. All right. Well, but on the other hand, we do face a very serious problem where continually, and today, I mean, just day by day, how many millions of plastic bottles that are marketed for water. And you know, when you think about it, you make a point in the film that when water is put in a plastic bottle, in certain types of plastic bottles, things leach out that are very dangerous for health. And it doesn't affect just the people at the moment. It affects generations down. And that's a very, very heavy thing. And I think your film is a remarkable film in the breadth that it embraces in terms of what's the problem and also how it goes to all these different people, scientists, ordinary people, and talks about what's going on with plastic? What are the dangers? How are people living? What do they plan to do about it? And really, I think that's a great exposure of the industry, too. Werner, thank you very much for that film, man.
Thank you very much, Michael.
Okay. And the film is Plastic Planet. It's distributed by First Run Features, and it will be available on DVD in April. All right. We have been had a really great show today, and I've been thinking about this for a while. And I think one of the points in terms of the theme, you know, you think about the theme of this show, and there's a point that Avakian talked about. Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, talked about there's a place where epistemology meets morality, that it's not acceptable to say, I don't choose to know about that, or I choose not to believe that, or I choose not to do anything about that because it gets you outside of your comfort zone. Well, this is morally reprehensible and unacceptable and has to be challenged. And as Chris Hedges said, we need a movement of resistance. Actually, we need mass resistance is what I would say. I had a little bit of a difference there. We need mass resistance that's part of an overall movement for revolution, a revolution that will fundamentally change society, because it's not enough to do good in a bad world. You got to fundamentally change the whole thing. And a couple of other things before we go out. Last week, I played All Played Out, a spoken word piece from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And I wanted to let people know that if you want to get that, I've had a lot of people call up or write in and request where they can listen to it again, where they can get it, where they can download it. If you want to do that, go to revcom.us. Okay, you can get All Played Out at revcom.us. That's the site for Revolution Newspaper. And you can download it there. You can you know, listen to it again. You can figure out ways to actually spread it around. And there's all kinds of suggestions there for things that people can do to help popularize that. So again, that's revcom.us. And also with that same site, this is something I want to start doing more and more, is referring people to that site for articles on some of the hottest issues that are going on today, and including right now at revcom.us, there is a tremendous article and one that has a very unique perspective. It's a communist analysis of what's going on in Egypt, what happened in Tunisia, why it, you know, what are all the big questions posed up in there, and what does it represent in the world today? So again, that's revcom.us. I want to thank my engineer for today, Teddy Robinson. I want to thank my production assistant, Henry Carson, and all of my guests, and that would be Chris Hedges, P.Z. Myers, P.Z. Myers and the infamous Feringula Gang. Okay, they travel with him wherever he goes. And again, remember, P.Z. has asked people to write in to the site that's trying to get P.Z. christened as the new Antichrist, and P.Z. is really upset that he's not getting enough votes. So go to that site. It's called Pray for P.Z., and you can, too, sign up and vote for P.Z. as the Antichrist. Okay, so he would be really appreciative of that. And I also want to thank Werner Butte, who's the director and writer of the film Plastic Planet, a really fantastic film, which will be coming out in April from First Run Features. All right, and one last thing, if you want to holler about the show, you can holler at me by writing to me at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. We're going to go out now with a song that I think really is fitting for the topics of this week's show, and that song is Naked from Everlast. All right, so check this out, Naked.
Let it ride, lose your money, lose your pride. Easy came, easy went, ghetto slums, tenements. Things look real Old Testament, blame it out on the president. The emperor's got brand new clothes and everybody but him knows he's naked. But you don't say a word. The emperor's got brand new jewels. Wake up soon, you silly fools, he's naked.